last decade.
As the news of his death spread far and wide, authorities swung into action and sealed the roads leading to Gilani's Haidarpura residence. Security was beefed up across the region, barricades erected, and key roads sealed, calling and internet services were shut. According to his family members, the former lawmaker, who after quitting electoral politics in late 1980s had for years spearheaded the separatist movement in Kashmir, had desired to be buried in Srinagar's historic martyrs' graveyard. But the family members alleged that police forcibly took away his body and in a quiet funeral, buried him in a graveyard near his residence.
He passed away late evening. We live in his neighborhood. We were neither allowed to visit his residence to pay him last respect, not allowed to participate in his funeral sitting COVID. This is very unfortunate. It will hurt us forever.
We wanted to participate in the funeral procession of our leader, but we were not allowed by forces. He was hurriedly buried and no one was allowed to say him the final goodbye. At least we should have been allowed to offer funeral prayers.
Known for his pro-Pakistan stance, Gilani led several anti-India protests and marches. He became a household name during 2008 and 2010 public uprising in Kashmir. A staunch advocate of Kashmir's right to self-determination, Gilani had stepped down as Hurriyat Conference chairman after he suffered with ailing health. He was conferred Pakistan's highest civilian honor in 2020. His death has been widely condoled, with Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan describing him as, quote, Mujahid-e-Kashmir. Meanwhile, police spokesman has said that there has been no incident of violence or protest in Kashmir after Gilani's death. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts. Sidri Safib, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A new major victory has been achieved by the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's oil-rich province of Marib. Yemen's armed forces have recaptured the strategic Rahabat district and the southern Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Al-Bayda and Marib will be cut off from the Saudi-backed forces.
Cutting off the supplies in Al-Rahba would weaken the enemy forces. There is also synchronization in the movement of our forces in the rest of the northern and southern fronts towards the city of Marib, and this constitutes a siege on the city from all sides. All supplies have been cut off from the Saudi-led forces, and they can no longer carry out any military action. Light weapons will be more effective, and the army is now able to advance more towards Harib and Al-Juba.
The Yemeni army has also managed to take control of other military sites overlooking the city of Marib from the western and northern sides, which would help the armed forces continue advancing towards the Harib and Al-Juba areas.
The Yemeni army managed to liberate the entire district of Al-Rahba and cut off the supply routes from Al-Baida. With that, the liberation of Al-Juba and Habri area became easier for the Yemeni army. There is an insistence by the Yemeni army to liberate the city of Marib, especially after the Saudi-led coalition's rejection of Ansar Allah's recent initiative to stop military operations there.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations aimed at liberating the strategic Marib province from the Saudi-backed forces, including terrorist groups. Marib has strategic importance as an oil-rich province. It is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen.
Yemenis believe that the army will eventually liberate Marib from all foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. They say now Riyadh has to bear the consequences of its disregard for Ansarullah's recent initiative to end the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Overnight security clampdown and communications blackout occurred in Indian-administered Kashmir after the region's iconic leader, Syed Ali Shah Gilani, died. The mosques in the region announced the demise. However, Gilani's followers were not able to participate in his funeral prayers.
Every home in Kashmir is mourning this loss. Authorities did not allow anyone to move out of homes. They should not have done this. It was our right to participate in his funeral prayers. After all, India claims to be a democracy. Can't we even mourn?
Officials say people's participation could have resulted in massive law and order problems.
Restrictions were imposed to keep law and order in place. No untoward incident occurred anywhere during the last 24 hours, and the situation has been peaceful.
Kashmir has witnessed a record number of internet blackouts in the world and is the world's largest militarized zone. Analysts say people of Kashmir have been forced into this silence since India stripped Kashmir of its autonomous status in August 2019.
The silence which was imposed upon the people is a human rights violation. They could not go to attend the funeral of their one of the veteran tallest leaders of Jammu and Kashmir, who has all along his life said and advocated about the right to self-determination.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned the Indian government's denial of right to choose burial rituals inside of the Sayyid Ali Shah Gilani. Observers say people of Kashmir have been forced into a controlled kind of a life where every rule is not set by their choice, but by the force of the governing authorities.
Sayyid Ali Gilani was one of the tallest leaders of the resistance movement of Jammu and Kashmir and was advocating for right to self-determination. He deserved a respectful funeral, but the government did not allow the funeral to happen other than his family members. International covenants and international law says that every person who dies is to be handed over to his family for a choicest burial and a choicest funeral.
People of Kashmir say since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party took a unanimous decision on Kashmir's special status in August 2019, a lot has changed without their consent. They say the silence of international community on the plight of Kashmiri people has added to their miseries, and with each passing day, living in the controlled land is getting difficult for them. And sooner or later, Kashmiri people are going to be the world's new asylum seekers. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
House was recently bombed by a U.S. drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the U.S. drone strike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Imal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the U.S. airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish Foreign Minister said in a joint presser with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said His country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse. Assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about the Master of the Martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned. The main person who laments and shed tears for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the first 10 days of the month of Muharram is the infallible Wali, or the guardian of that time, in our case, Imam al-Mahdi. This has been the case during the time of all Shia Imams like Imam Musa al-Kazim, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, and Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. This means that the main host for the majalis of Imam al-Hussein during the month of Muharram is a masum or infallible.
Karbala, as I step onto your sands, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed beneath your skies.
امام رضا می فرمود که پدرم موسی بن جعفر از روز اول محرم لا یرازا.
امام رضا علیه السلام used to say, from the first day of the month of Muharram, no one could see a smile on the face of my father, Musa ibn Ja'far. His sadness on the tragedy of Karbala will increase day and day up to the day of Ashura, when he shed tears profusely on the afflictions which befell upon Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions. Now in our time and age, the main host for the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is Imam al-Mahdi. He is the living masum of our time. We are only able to hear the events of Karbala, but Imam al-Mahdi, since he is an infallible, could see the sad details of the events of Karbala.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura, always full of mysteries. Ashura, always full of mysteries.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there. Ashura, Al-Hussein was murdered.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Next Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center buildings in New York City. The attacks resulted in tragic death of nearly 3,000 people, while thousands more were injured. For 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have refused to release classified documents related to the investigations of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The documents reportedly could expose a potential link between Saudi Arabia and the hijackers, as 15 out of 19 alleged attackers were Saudi nationals. Also, publicly released documents, including by the 9/11 Commission, have detailed numerous Saudi entanglements, but failed to prove government complicity. The Saudi government has routinely denied any connections to the attacks. In recent months, pressure has mounted on the Biden administration as families of the 9/11 victims demand answers in regard to Saudi government's role in the terrorist attacks on the U.S. soil. Last month, nearly 1,800 Americans directly affected by the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center called on U.S. President Joe Biden to skip the 20th anniversary events unless he upholds his pledge to declassify evidence that could link Saudi Arabia to the attack. President Biden is currently facing sharp criticism over his administration's response to the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country after 20 years of war. It seems, in a bid to deflect the criticism and the pressure on his shoulders, Biden finally gave in and signed an executive order which directs the Justice Department and other federal agencies to begin a review of documents and release declassified information over the next 6 months. U.S. officials assert that Al-Qaeda terrorists carried out the 9/11 attacks. However, many experts and independent researchers have questioned the official account. They believe that rogue elements within the U.S. government orchestrated or at least encouraged the 9/11 attacks in order to accelerate the U.S. war machine and advance the Zionist agenda.
I think it is implausible to believe that 19 people, most of whom didn't speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, many of whom didn't have a high school education, could have carried out such a complicated task without some support from within the United States.
Bob Graham and others believe that the United States has deliberately shielded the Saudi Arabia by refusing to expose their links to the attacks in order to protect the Washington-Riyadh relationship. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports between 2016 and 2020. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Furthermore, U.S. President Joe Biden has previously refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign.
Well, I don't know. The Saudis will definitely react. Whether the United States will do anything, I don't know. I think that the implication here is that we would reduce arms sales or something like that. But, you know, there's such pressures on the economy to maintain the arms sales that I think that there will be some comments, there will be efforts by the Progressive Caucus in the Democratic Party to rein in the Saudis. But I think in the end, unless the real leadership in the State Department and the CIA decides that the Saudis are too much of a price to pay, that other than comments, nothing is going to happen.
Washington has been shielding Riyadh for the 9/11 attacks for two decades. What's for sure is that the lucrative alliance with the Saudis and the kingdom's green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as the safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us, 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States. Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe, with its colonial history, it's certainly, you know, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then-administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president, Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. military personnel. The final U.S. evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. U.S. military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram Air Base and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion U.S. dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
the war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, illegitimate wealth. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. It is a common belief that some types of properties are unsuitable for spending on public welfare or charity. We have a tradition from Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first infallible Imam, the commander of the faithful. He says, he who acquires wealth illegitimately will spend it in ways which confer no divine reward. This tradition is a good proof for this public belief, and one can verify it because one can see cases where some individuals have intended to participate in a good cause using their property, but they have either stopped halfway or their project, though completed, is not effective or even counterproductive. On the other hand, one finds a lot of faithful and virtuous individuals who have accomplished a lot of good work with their meager resources. You know, sometimes we think that if resources are thrown at an Islamic project or a good cause, it is bound to give results. Well, not necessarily. And, you know, if you look at the empirical evidences we have, one can argue that in most cases, it's the other way around. People and individuals with very few resources have been able to impact and be effective, whereas those projects which were huge, they had a lot of wealth and money thrown at them, they were not effective, they were not successful. Yes, they were completed because of the money, but the effectiveness and the impact was not there. You know, one of the major reasons for that is the wealth that is being used to run those projects. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the impacts of illegitimate wealth. So if we spend a lot of wealth on any good cause, if it is illegitimate, rest assured it's not going to be effective. It's not going to be fruitful. The project may complete. You may see this huge building, but it's not going to be effective. Now, the divine reward that Imam Ali alayhi salam has mentioned comes as a result of following the due process. Doing a good act is important in Islam. There's no doubt about it, right? doing good, doing charity work, you know, running good projects. It is all good. It is important. But what is more important is to do a good act with pure resources, channels, and intentions. And of course, this intention is very important in Islam. What are you thinking? What are you planning? What is in the back of your mind? Do you have dual motives or no? How many times have we noticed and turned a blind eye on whether the wealth is coming or where the wealth is coming from, whether it is legitimate or illegitimate, whether it has trampled over the rights of other human beings or it is clean and pure money, whether it is the wealth that the khums has been paid on and it has been purified by paying Islamic taxes or it is not? How many times do we turn a blind eye towards it? For example, in the West, there are some gas stations I've seen. You know, these gas station owners, they donate money to the mosques. Well, in some cases, these same gas stations sell haram food items or alcoholic beverages or, you know, lottery, for instance. So the question is, what makes us think that the income from that gas station that is being donated for a good cause now can be beneficial for the donor of the wealth and the hereafter? Do we expect Allah to give divine rewards in exchange? Well, that would be equivalent to Allah turning a blind eye towards where their wealth is coming from. And we know Allah is above and beyond this. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
For decades, U.S. dollars have been dominating global trade. And for years, the United States has been flexing its financial muscle through its dollars. The country's unilateral sanctions, for example, could never be imaginable without the unique position the greenback has held in international trade since World War II. Yet this dominance by no means is to be permanent. In fact, there are many factors now at play challenging the almighty dollar. During World War II, the U.S. served as the Allies' main provider of weapons, supplies, and other goods. Collecting much of its payment in gold by the end of the war, the U.S. owned the vast majority of the world's gold. So after the war, countries linked their currencies to the dollar, which was linked to gold, and instead of gold reserves, they accumulated reserves of U.S. dollars. Needing a place to store their dollars, they began buying U.S. Treasury securities, considered to be a safe store of money. The demand for Treasury securities, coupled with the deficit spending needed to finance the Vietnam War and the Great Society domestic programs launched by President Lyndon B. Johnson, caused the U.S. to flood the market with paper money. With growing concerns over the stability of the dollar, countries began to convert dollar reserves into gold. The demand for gold was such that President Richard Nixon was forced to intervene and de-link the dollar from gold, which led to the floating exchange rates that exist today. Although the US dollar has remained the world's reserve currency for decades, issues such as large deficit spending, trillions of dollars in debt, and the unbridled printing of U.S. dollars are shaking its status. In early May, billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller sounded a warning that the dollar could cease to be the prominent global reserve currency within 15 years. His warning comes against the backdrop of a long-standing retreat from the dollar as the world has moved gradually towards a multiple reserve currency system. The IMF's latest survey shows that shares of US dollar reserves held by central banks fell to 59% during the fourth quarter of 2020, its lowest level in 25 years. The US accounted for the majority of the industrial production of the non-Soviet world after the Second World War, so it made sense that the dollar was the principal unit in which exporters and importers invoiced and settled their trade, in which international loans were extended, and in which central banks held their reserves. But today, with the U.S. accounting for less than a quarter of global gross domestic product, it makes less sense. The latest IMF numbers indicate countries that trade with and borrow from the euro area increasingly seek to hold euro reserves. That process is now happening with China and the renminbi. Inside the United States, there are mounting fears that the Federal Reserve's mismanagement, coupled with Joe Biden's careless fiscal policy and inflation, could undermine the dollar. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers has recently said, "The Biden administration is pursuing the least responsible fiscal macroeconomic policy we've had for the last 40 years," adding, "We're seeing an episode that I think differs both quantitatively and qualitatively from anything since Paul Volcker's days at the Fed. And it stands to reason that that would lead to significant changes in expectations." In other words, the anti-inflationary credibility won by the Fed over the past 40 years may now be in question, causing foreign investors to worry that the US will inflate away the value of their treasury holdings. Against such a backdrop, the world is looking for other viable alternatives. For example, the European Union is trying to create a recovery fund financed by commonly used EU debt. Although the move is yet tentative, it suggests that the euro, currently making up to 20% of global reserves, could play an increasing role. In the case of the renminbi, Beijing is committed to challenging the dollar and has actively encouraged the use of the renminbi in bilateral trade transactions. The Belt and Road Initiative provides new financing opportunities for the digital renminbi currently under development. And Beijing has the advantage that China has recovered more strongly than the other big economies from the COVID-19 setback. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as China has progressively opened up its financial markets. The wild card here relates to digital currencies. Geeta Gopinath, IMF chief economist, believes that technology has plenty to offer in providing cheaper and faster cross-border payments and improving financial inclusion.
Many institutional investors are trying to expose to the cryptocurrency. They are holding Bitcoin as an alternative asset to hedge the risk of global monetary easing. And also some retail investors, they just discovered new ways to hold crypto assets because PayPal just opened their cryptocurrency business services to their retail users in U.S. market. So from the demand side, there's a huge surge.
Finally, what might undermine the dominance of the U.S. dollar is the weaponization of the dollar, or the U.S. government's exploitation of the currency's global dominance to extend the extraterritorial reach of U.S. law and policy. The most outstanding example is the Trump administration's enforcement of economic sanctions against Iran in an attempt to shut the country out of the international banking system, and in particular, SWIFT.
I think the U.S. has weaponized American dollar together with the international payment system known as the SWIFT system. Therefore, any company in the world, if it is doing business using U.S. dollars, actually, it is under the supervision of the American authority.
Faced almost with the same sanctions, Russia shifted its reserves out of the dollars in 2018 and is selling its oil in non-dollar currencies. Likewise, Europe or China may succeed in developing alternative payment mechanisms that would allow countries such as Iran to sell its oil. That might in turn undermine the dollar's role in the long run.
Just the very fact that the Americans do use their extraterritorial power over the dollar in lots and lots of different ways does make other countries now more likely to look at non-dollar currencies to hold their reserves. It also pushes countries into gold, for example. We've seen that with the Russians.
If the pace of financial sanctions continues to grow over the next decade, it might increase the attractiveness of cross-border payment systems based on the euro, renminbi, or other alternatives. With the dollar facing all these challenges, Washington is expected to have a hard time maintaining its current hegemony in the years to come.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند این ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Dear brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. The distortions reached the state that the Quran was misused by tyrannical governments and by the more wicked preachers than the oppressors in order to establish injustice and corruption and for legitimization of the rule of oppressors and enemies of the Almighty Allah. Unfortunately, for the enemies and for the ignorant friends, the Quran, this determinant book, has no role other than recitation in the graveyards and funeral ceremonies.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Khomeini was quoted saying, "It is narrated that he who cries for Imam al-Hussein, martyrdom, or make others cry, or even he who puts on a weeping appearance, will be admitted to heaven." Now, Imam al-Khomeini took this quote from a hadith itself, from the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, where they speak so highly of those who cry or those who even put on a sad face. Now, the question is, most people ask, like, they say, well, that's just ridiculous that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will enter you and admit you to heaven just for crying or putting a sad face. That's not how simple it is. Now, we do understand that with every action that we do, when we pray, when we fast, and all other actions, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has attached rewards to them. You read certain verse and Allah will give you a certain amount. You say, subhanallah, Allah will build a castle for you in heaven. Now, obviously, there are attachments as rewards to the actions that we do. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not want you to be stuck on the reward. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. If you put yourself in a sad mood, you might slowly start to become what? Emotional. If you become emotional, your heart is opened, your mind is opened, your spirituality is on, and then you could elevate yourself. So when they say there's a reward for every tear, which is heaven, obviously considering the fact that it will open the doors for you. And the same thing with salah, and the same thing with siyam. So don't get stuck on the reward and you forget the aim and the goal of crying and lamenting for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
IRIB English Radio.